I'd like to introduce John Bonitz, and I have a comment. John is a very informative person. I have seen him at many of the biochar talks. I have seen him be an excellent listener. And that's happened over 3 to 4 years. And I figure after listening to several hundreds or how many biochar talks, biofuel talks, that he would absorb a lot of that. And if you look at his web pages, he expounds a lot of wisdom. And I felt it was my opportunity to invite him to preach some of that to us with, again, his topic, as you see here on the slide. But also, I personally wanted him to speak because I think this is his time to be up on the podium instead of in the crowd. But I'd like to introduce John Bonitz. You have the floor.
Thank you so much, Jeff. So I've been privileged for 7.5 years to be working as a nonprofit environmental advocate for bioenergy, really trying to thread that needle of sustainability, because there is this tension among my peers, environmental peers, regarding whether or not we can even use any amount of biomass sustainably for any displacement of fossil energy. I've done that with an organization called the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And SACE is a Southeast regional organization. We are very much regionally focused in 5 states of the Southeast. But funding has run out, and so I am shifting my roles. I did still want to share these perspectives as an individual, deeply committed to environmental causes. And just a little bit about myself. So I'm a generalist. I was trained in public policy in grad school. But before that, as an undergrad, I had to write my own major because I was so interested in going beyond the existing curriculum and disciplines to deeply understand environmental problems and environmental problem solving. So I ended up with just short of a major in chemistry, biology, physics, and geography. So that's a rather odd hodgepodge, but I'm privileged to be able to be somewhat of a consumer of science and also yet still very passionate about environment. Speaking of which, I'm trying to do paperless notes. The first thing that I want to point out is, you know, as soil scientists, y'all know, there's many, many uses of biomass in ecosystems. But when we think about human uses of biomass, I think it's helpful to just revisit this Venn diagram that points out, there are bioproducts, paper, soy-based inks, etc., chemicals. Then there's the whole realm of bioenergy in the warmer colors. Biopower would be biomass electricity. Biofuels would be the liquid stuff. And then we could also produce heat from biomass, obviously, wood fire. And there's this distinct series of overlaps within those categories. And nicely in the middle, there's biochar, the black triangle. Just as there are very many uses for biomass, human uses for biomass, there's the same diversity extends to the people, the businesses, and the organizations who are interested in bioenergy. And Ty Miles' presentation really emphasized that, the various sizes and scale of industry and devices that can make biochar. It includes households, small businesses, large businesses, small farms, large farms, many different industries. Just among the industrial users, we have biofuels producers, both biochemical and thermochemical, biomass power plants, pulp and paper mills, chemical companies, wood products industries, brick makers, cement kilns, just to name a few of the industries. This huge diversity means that biomass policy making, in other words, government involvement, is much more difficult than for other renewable energy sources. It's very challenging to even get everyone to the table together, let alone to achieve agreement on common policy agenda. And this is before we layer on the complex and contentious environmental and climate questions raised with visions of increased biomass utilization. As somebody who's been privileged to do this work for so long, on the environmental sustainability of bioenergy, it's my opinion that none of these questions are showstoppers. On the biomass supply issues, we have many tools at our disposal. These are just a few tools to reduce environmental harm. Kelpie's presentation went into greater detail on some of those. I think it's also useful to take a little side note here, because I heard in the conversation during the Q&A from some of the prior presentations, perhaps a little uncertainty about these questions of feedstocks. Which feedstocks are likely? Which feedstocks should we be investing our time and effort in? And I would just like to observe that, from my perspective, I have yet to see a closed-loop bioenergy system of any kind in commercial operation. In other words, I have yet to see an energy crop actually turn a dollar. So I just want to introduce a note of caution. This is a side note. It's just that when we think about energy crops, that we should really be mindful of the fact that the vast majority of material being used for bioenergy today is forest biomass and its residuals, its waste. The idea of growing something to put it in a boiler is very unlikely, I think. Now, in the future, it may be very different. Indeed, if we pass meaningful climate law, if we put a price on carbon, that may change dramatically. But the notion of food versus fuel and so on and so forth, I think we just need to be mindful of the realities today and how far we would have to go to get to that point. As an example, actual data show that there's more woodlands being cleared for agriculture, for food production, for feed production, than for bioenergy. In North Carolina, we're consuming farmland and forest land for very large solar farms, believe it or not. The only instance of food for fuel I've ever laid eyes on has been actual food land converted to solar farms. And it's happening. In North Carolina, I count over 1,000 acres so far. So let's just keep things in perspective on these notes. Now, I'm not going to dwell on this slide. We can move past this. It's mainly intended for those who are interested in producing char or bioenergy. It is definitely true that not all bioenergy is climate friendly. And this is from a very important study that was done in the southeastern United States. Anyone in bioenergy may have heard about the study called the ManoMet study. It was conducted in the state of Massachusetts, and the ManoMet study was widely touted in headlines as suggesting that biomass electricity was going to take 100 years before it could provide any climate benefit. Granted, that was Massachusetts forests. The big difference between this study and the ManoMet study was that this is in southeastern forests, in the southeastern United States, where trees are planted to be cut. We grow trees as a crop. However, they did find in their model that it would take somewhere between 15 and 50 years to see that carbon released in a brief moment by the bioenergy facility reabsorbed by the landscape, by the forest. So indeed, it is easy to conceive of a bioenergy system that harms the climate. However, a much less reported figure from the same study showed that, what do you know, what we're doing today actually has a massive and immediate benefit to the climate. The reason is because of the feedstock in current bioenergy in the Southeast, which is predominantly biomass electricity, and predominantly these inefficient boilers that are detached from any use for the waste heat. In other words, 70% of the energy just goes up the smokestack or out the evaporator system. They are using true waste and residuals. They're using bark, sawdust, and unmerchantable byproducts from cutting wood for paper or for lumber. The other important thing is that this particular model outcome, this particular graph, was based on a modeling projection that understood trees are going to be cut anyway. Trees are not cut just to throw into a boiler. This said, there is some of that going on. There is some, in the Southeast especially, entire tracts of timber being cut, pelletized, and shipped abroad. And I maintain that that is a product of it's a market dislocation because we have no climate policy and they do. The Europeans and the UK are trying to do something about climate. The United States does not. In the absence of this, we farmers or woodland owners have no incentive to maintain those trees as forests or give that wood higher value as long-lived timber in multi-story buildings, for example. This is just to point out that there is a diversity of opinion in the environmental movement. This perspective that there is a difference between the carbon emissions from fossil and a massive immediate benefit from biopower, even inefficient biopower in the southeastern United States, this is poorly understood even among my environmental peers. It was essentially buried in the report. It was not discussed in the text. But the modelers themselves said, yes, absolutely, that's valid. Your interpretation is spot on, John. But all of this is just to point out that carbon is really important in bioenergy, and bioenergy is really important for char production. We really shouldn't be wasting our time trying to make char on any significant scale without making bioenergy. We're not helping the climate if we do that. Now, another important thing that I can share with you is some observations about this EPA process. The Environmental Protection Agency, 3 years ago, no, it was more than 3 years ago, said very clearly and loudly, biomass no longer gets a free pass on carbon emissions. We cannot assume a priori that carbon emissions are neutral from biomass. Industry doesn't like to believe this. They're still in denial about it. But it is absolutely true that we have to be mindful of the time frame of carbon re-sequestration in the landscape. And indeed, the EPA is planning to issue some guidance on this. They are required under law to issue something called a biogenic accounting framework. In the document that I reference here, they did indeed discuss biochar, so they've left open the opportunity for themselves to at least deal with the concept of carbon negativity, bioenergy that actively sequesters carbon, not merely striving for mediocrity or carbon neutrality. But they have apparently been dogged by the complexity of this task. And so they missed their deadline, which was July. That was the end of the three-year deferral. And they're planning to, the new intelligence suggests that EPA is preparing to issue informal guidance that would tie together three major biopower-related regulatory initiatives. I could discuss those on the sideline. And the release of this document is expected shortly after the election. The only other guidance we've been received on it is that the head of the EPA has said in a public venue that she expects that it's going to be done before year end. But this should give us some guidance, at least on the boundaries, the general the space in which EPA is directing their thinking on how to regulate biogenic carbon. And I hope and pray that it will indeed address the option of sequestering carbon through biochar. I'm going to shift past this. Okay, so both Kelpie and Tom mentioned these legacy biomass boilers. And this is the vision that I have because the backyard retorts, the small-scale devices, the homemade kilns, even in developing countries, may provide benefits to the immediate land or the user, but the real tonnage of carbon molecules being stored is going to come from the existing infrastructure, I believe. I think that there's an argument to be made, and it's already been made in literature, I can provide citations, that we humans may not have sufficient wealth to retool our entire energy system. We're going to have to reuse existing infrastructure and systems, including these old stinky boilers that are already in the landscape. And it is true, and Tom can speak to this in much greater detail than I can, that the existing fleet of biomass boilers, and indeed some other solid fuel boilers, coal-fired boilers, can produce high-carbon wood ash or high-carbon biomass ash. Many of these systems are already recirculating and re-injecting the carbon back into the boiler. In other words, they have a tube already installed. I'll show you a picture. Right here is a pneumatic re-injection system that is, we could just simply turn the tube and have a ready supply of char of a quality. We can determine that. We can analyze that and understand its usefulness based on its particularities. Still more of these existing boilers could be tuned to run in what's called sub-stoichiometric mode to produce yet more carbon, high carbon ash. And given that EPA is planning to regulate biomass, biogenic carbon emissions, I am hopeful that this will be considered. And anyone who has any appetite for contacting their elected officials might think about this. Just another note here about these reinjection systems. I was talking with a boiler operator, a plant operator. He manages the whole facility, biopower plant in Virginia, and he shared with me the observation that of the entire plant, the entire power plant, this pneumatic reinjection system for carbon, which captures carbon out of the ash and puts it back into the boiler, is the highest maintenance system on his plant. And it's the one that bedevils him the most, and he would be very happy to just turn it off and send that to a truck and market that stuff. So as Tom pointed out, the issue of production of char is really not the concern. We can produce an awful lot more char than our markets can currently absorb. But the imperative is really, it's huge. You know, we all know we're at 400 parts per million currently. We've got to get down to 350 parts per million is what's recommended. And honestly, it would be probably safer if we could strive towards the 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that we know was the case before the Industrial Revolution. And current efforts at reducing greenhouse gases through wind power, solar power, energy efficiency, reduced consumption of fossil fuels are absolutely inefficient. It's insufficient. We must make greater strides to actively suck carbon out of the atmosphere and put it in the ground. Well, what do the greatest minds in this field of energy modeling and carbon modeling and greenhouse gas, what do they think we should do? They think that we should take this system called clean coal and capture, feed it instead of coal, we should feed it biomass, and we should capture these emissions from the smokestack as gaseous carbon, liquefy it, and then pump it underground. Which in my mind is really just sweeping it under the rug. This is called biomass energy with carbon capture and sequestration, or BECCS. Yes, 1 minute. All right, thank you. So it's very clear. If you do that, you get none of the co-benefits unless you're an oil company, and then you get to increase your amount of oil recovery. That doesn't help the planet, whereas char obviously helps in so many ways with the ecosystems, with food production, and so on and so forth. That is the end. I guess that I would just put the final note on my encouragement that we're all frustrated with the pace that commercial biochar sellers are making in their claims and in trying to merchandise their material, and the difference between what we really know. But I would challenge everyone in the audience who is passionate about getting the science right to strive to listen more to the commercial operators, because they're the ones who are going to build the market for this material. And we need to pay attention to their needs in order to have our science be most meaningful, unless we're really working on just the base science. So thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate this opportunity. It's been a privilege to speak to you. And I'm happy to take questions. Well, those are, again, Tom can speak to this in much greater detail than I can, but my impression is that those are very complex and expensive systems, the pyrolysis systems. The systems that are designed first and foremost to make char, and then secondarily we'll use the energy or we'll make some biofuels or something like that, they're, I really don't want to be disparaging, but they're kind of white elephants, and we really need to acknowledge that there are existing technologies that work in conserving carbon, in putting this carbon into a very permanent charred form, and in paying their own bills and paying off their financing costs. And those are boilers. And those boilers also can be modified and tuned to make higher quality chars. So, yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, although I was actually in my mind thinking about catalysis systems, I guess I'm specialized.
The what pyrolysis?
Fast pyrolysis.
Fast pyrolysis, so for liquid fuels. Yeah, and the liquid fuel production, oh my goodness, I'm very hopeful that we're going to be able to commercialize biofuels. The challenges there have been made much, much greater recently because of the technology of hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling, which has lowered the costs of producing oil and natural gas, making it much harder for those biofuels developers and R&D guys to raise funds. Their business case has kind of gone away with oil at $80 a barrel.
Thank you very much. We have a round of applause for this presentation. Thank you.